that there won't be any fireworks between us. We approach this basically in the same way, and here's where the real fireworks come. There, I'm sure, are differences of emphasis, but I can't detect any differences in principle. So we're going to have to rely on the audience this morning to supply the fireworks. And if there are, how many of you are businessmen? What do you do?
We're civil engineers and surveyors.
Anybody else?
General Motors.
General Motors. We don't have any retailers or druggists here. That's left. Oh, gee, that's too bad. Because that's too bad. We really need some small businessmen here. You will? Yeah, that's what General Motors always says. Papa knows best. What's good for
the group of ladder small business?
That's right. What's good for General Motors is good for the retail druggists.
Right. Vice versa.
Well, anyway, I'm going to take very little time to present some supplementary remarks to Vern's very clear and excellent presentation yesterday, and then give him a chance to respond, if he cares to anything I've said. And then we'd like to throw it open to you for questions directed to either of us or for impassioned speeches that you feel compelled to make. Picking up sort of where he left off, the basic antitrust law of the United States, the Sherman Act, passed in 1890, states flatly in the very first section that every contract, combination, or conspiracy and restraint of trade in interstate commerce is illegal. But clearly, as Vern pointed out, it can't mean that, because any contract and every contract restrains trade. As soon as you sign an agreement with your fuel oil distributor to pay him $17 a month beginning in September and running through June, and he will supply all your oil needs, you have restrained trade. You have now made it impossible for the other fuel oil distributors to get your business. But quite obviously, this kind of contract is necessary for the conduct of ordinary affairs, and the law doesn't intend to forbid it. What the law does intend to forbid is unreasonable restraints of trade. But what is unreasonable? Well, Congress probably intended in 1890 to let the courts decide this. Congress was laying down the principle, and now it was up to the courts to fit the principle to particular cases. The trouble with this was that no one then could know in advance what the law was. There were other difficulties, that the courts often lacked the kind of expertise that was required to implement the policy that Congress was rather vaguely enunciating here. Businessmen did not like the idea of maybe going to jail for violating a law whose implications they could not understand in advance. And so there was considerable demand for spelling out in detail what Congress meant by unreasonable acts. And then we got the Clayton Act and the Federal Trade Commission Act in 1914, and then in the 1930s we added to this, we got even more specific. We have tried to steer some kind of middle course between vagueness, with which we cannot live, and over-specificness, with which it is also very difficult to live. But we haven't steered this middle course too successfully. Now, those in the business and economic community who have reflected on the problem of defining unreasonable conduct or unreasonable acts can be divided usefully into two groups. And I will call them the performance people and the structure people. The performance people are those who want us to look at what is actually done, look at the performance of business. the structure people want us to look away from actual acts and take a look instead at market structures, at such things as elasticities of demand. All right, now I want to try to show what the argument is about here. The performance people frequently say, well, what we're interested in is low prices, good quality products, lots of innovation. That's what we think competition leads to. So, let's take a look at a business or an industry and see if prices are low and quality is good and there's innovation. And if there is, well, let's just say the conduct must be reasonable. That makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, with General Motors, for example, if they're cranking out fine quality cars at low prices and they're always innovating, putting marvelous new things on their cars such as chrome, then what do we care? What do we care what they do? Whatever they do, it must be good because it leads to a good performance. Now, the trouble with this approach is that it amounts to an invitation to non-enforcement. Because a business might not be innovating. It might be turning out poor quality products at high prices simply because it's inefficient or it's in a bad position. It's just unfortunate. Are we going to send a businessman to jail or fine him because he's inefficient or because he's got a bad break somewhere along the line? Well clearly not. And then too, what is a good performance? Now I would say, and the trouble is I can't prove it, because I don't know of any way to prove it, but I have the feeling that General Motors has done a remarkable job. I think General Motors' performance has been very good, but that's terribly vague, because what might General Motors' performance have been if it had been subjected to more rigorous competition? General Motors might have done a lot better. Or take United States Steel, where again I feel the performance has been quite bad. How do I know? I say, well, the price of steel is pretty high and the product has not been too good and U.S. Steel has definitely not been an innovator, but how do I know? What is possible? Clearly, just to take the matter of innovation, you would expect far more innovation in, let's say, the electrical products industry than in the steel industry. What criterion do you use for deciding that a particular firm or a particular industry is being sufficiently innovative? Or look at the drug industry. They're innovating all the time. But are these good innovations? Are they developing new products that will really benefit consumers? Or are they just stirring things around down in their laboratories in order to come up with something that they can patent and charge a high price for and bamboozle the public into believing that it does something for them when nobody really knows what it does and nobody has the slightest inkling of what the side effects are? How do you judge? That's the trouble. We think it's so easy to say what a good performance is, but a good performance always has to be measured against some standard. And in the absence of competition, that standard isn't clear. All right, now, another thing that the performance people will sometimes say is, well, at least we can do this. We can set up rules to regulate conduct. We want a good performance. We'll get a good performance if every businessman does only good things and avoids bad things. And now let's spell out what good things are and what bad things are. And we'll enjoin the businessman to be ethical or something like that. Well now, this also I think is a terrible trap. In fact, looking at history, when we have taken this route, we have time and again protected competitors at the expense of competition. We have enunciated rules for businessmen which hamper the efficient and innovating business firm and protect the inefficient and lazy business firm. Time and again this has occurred, and this is primarily, just looking at the record, why I say that this is a trap. We have tended, through much of our attempt to lay down rules, we have tended to destroy the system that Byrne said yesterday, and I agree, our trade policy, our trade regulation policy, ought to be designed to enhance and promote. We should be trying to improve the competitive system, and most of our rule laying down has actually tended to destroy the competitive system. Government has unfortunately, and I do not mean primarily even the federal government, I think the state governments have done much more, and to some extent local governments, but governments have unfortunately done a lot of disastrous things by taking this route. I'll mention just a few, and maybe this will provide the fireworks later. Fair trade laws, minimum price fixing, sometimes where the state directly sets minimum prices, other times where it turns over to the retailers the power to set the prices. Much of our licensing system, you gotta get a license in order to get into a particular trade or business, and who grants the license? Well, a committee of experts, and who's an expert? Obviously somebody who's already in the business. So what you do is you allow the local undertakers to decide whether another undertaker is needed in the community. And they never think another undertaker is needed, but how are they going to keep him out? The simplest way is to say that every undertaker must be a man of good moral character, and naturally, who wants to be embalmed by an immoral man? But how do you prove good moral character? Well, by getting an undertaker, presumably all existing undertakers are moral, get him to sign a character reference. But he won't do that because he doesn't want the competition. Well, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And then all kinds of, you'd be amazed if you get into it, the number of different price supporting or price fixing cartels that are supported by government, state governments in particular. Supposedly these are all designed to secure ethical practices, like the real estate contract that I signed when my realtor took over to try to sell a house for me. It said, in order to ensure ethical practices within the realty business, you must pay 5% of the value of the purchase price. In other words, this has been agreed upon by all of the realtors of the community in order to ensure ethical practices. An unethical practice here being defined as an attempt by a realtor to get my business by offering to do it for only 4.5%. Let me make a statement about this. That roughly describes the performance people and what they're looking for, and you can tell I don't like it too much. I'm not a performance people. And in fact, I've been hunting for some years, and I have found no economist whose specialty is in this area. Not one single economist who is a performance person. Every economist who, now there are some who don't know anything about this area, you know, whose specialty is international trade, who might be performance people, but the economists specializing in industry and public policy, none of them support the performance test. They are all in some way or the other, there are many variants of it, but they are all in some way structure people. Now, what are structure people like? Well, their basic rule is that if you want a competitive performance, i.e. a good performance, get a competitive structure. Competition leads to good performance. But now what is a competitive structure? Well, that turns out to be very, very hard to define, and I'm not going to get into the business of trying to define it. It means roughly, of course, a lot of different firms providing a lot of different products so that buyers always have a wide choice. Whenever buyers have a wide choice, sellers got to be on their toes. Now, the performance people want a minimum of rules, of specific rules. They think this is important because if you have too many rules, you destroy freedom of maneuver. You keep the businessman from trying out new possibilities. And this trying out of possibilities is the way in which the system works and improves itself and refreshes itself. So as few rules as possible to allow a great deal of room for maneuver on the part of businessmen. And meanwhile, public policy can do a number of things, and I will mention three. One, view mergers with great suspicion. Place upon the potential mergerer, sounds like murderer, doesn't it? It's good. Place the burden of proof upon him. In other words, if Chrysler wants to merge with Mack, it is not up to the government to prove that that will destroy competition. Because Chrysler is plenty big and Mack is plenty big, and it seems to the performance people, there's reason for believing on the face of it that this will eliminate some competition. Now let Chrysler and Mack prove that it won't. Do away with the idea that every firm has an inalienable right to merge with everybody else. This is nonsense. So view every merger with suspicion and make the firm that wants to merge prove. Put the burden of proof on the firm that this will not eliminate competition. Secondly, maintain the Sherman Act prohibitions, as the courts have now defined them, on joint price fixing, the kind of thing that was done in the electrical industry so spectacularly, against market division, you know, getting together and saying, well, look, we'll sell in Ohio and you sell in Missouri, and if we don't send our salesmen into your territory and you don't send your salesmen into our territory, then there won't be this tendency to cut prices, you see. You sort of have a gentleman's agreement to concentrate in your own market that tends to eliminate price competition. Well, these things are forbidden by the Sherman Act. Any businessman who does them knows that he's violating the law, and he knows that if he gets caught, he may go to jail. There was no doubt about it in the case of the men in the electrical industry. They knew they were in violation of law. After all, you don't sign into a hotel under a false name and use a secret code to communicate if you think that you're within the scope of the law. There's one, Fortune magazine, I think, came up with the phrase first. The ghost of Senator Sherman sits at every meeting of the board of directors. And I like that idea. I think we ought to keep old Senator John sitting there. Even if you can't tell exactly what firms have not done by way of colluding with their competitors because of the Sherman Act, we can be pretty sure that there are some things they aren't doing. They got to be careful. And in that electrical industry, that's a good laboratory case. It turns out that when the law prohibits this kind of thing, it is extraordinarily difficult to run it successfully. See, all you need is one chiseler. And how are you going to get him? You can't haul him into court for violating an illegal conspiracy. Then the third thing. We will have to forbid some specific practices. But try to use this rule. Forbid specific practices only where they clearly mitigate the rigors of competition. And I don't find too many instances of that. We're a little naive about it. We listen too much. See, in the process of competition, some bull is always being gored. And the guy who's getting it, let's say the guy who just can't meet the competition, he's too inefficient. He will always scream that it's unfair practices, that it's all due to the big monopolist grinding down the face of the poor little man who made America great and all of that. Let us not believe him so readily. One comment quickly about something that Byrne brought up. The structure people are usually... Well, I'll say that economists are strongly structure people. Businessmen, to whom I've talked, are strongly performance people. And the businessman will complain when the economist talks structure like this. He'll say, yeah, this point that Byrne raised, doggone it, you can go to jail for a violation of the antitrust laws of the country. And this leaves it all too vague. I think that criticism is largely beside the point, because though you can go to jail for violations of certain portions of the antitrust law, no businessman ever has gone to jail, or I think will go to jail. There's no likelihood that any businessman will go to jail except for a clear violation of a portion of the law that he clearly knew forbade what he did. Would you agree with that, Vern? Businessmen do not go to jail for stepping across gray areas. For gray.
Historically, they have not. Of course, we have seen more criminals, more imprisonments.
You say historically they have.
Have not.
No.
No, for the first, from 1890 up until 1950, the only persons who went to prison were labor racketeers. There were very few.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last year, we've had more people going to prison for Sherman Act violations than we've ever had.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say that in each of these cases, these guys were engaging in a conspiracy to fix prices or allocate markets, and they knew what they were doing was illegal?
The thing that worries me, basically, yes. The thing that worries me is that you can have vicarious responsibility here.
Yeah.
Where the executive on top doesn't really know what his vice president is doing. He should.
Mm-hmm.
He's responsible. He's his agent. And it is at least theoretically possible, whether or not it actually happens is something else. But it's at least theoretically possible that he might do it for something he didn't know was going on. Bye-bye, Mark. Agreement with you,
basically. The thing is, the real morass and muddled mess of antitrust law today is found in the Federal Trade Commission Act and activities of the Federal Trade Commission, the Clayton Act and its amendment and the Robinson-Patman Act. When businessmen start citing horrible cases of how confused and contradictory the law is, almost inevitably they draw their examples out of here. But people aren't going to jail here. What they're getting is an injunction. They're told, cut it out. And that's about all. Now, if they refuse to cut it out, then they can get a fine. But I think, generally speaking, when the law is very, very confused here, you'll first be told, look, here's what we think the government, Federal Trade Commission, or somebody will say, here's what we think the law means. Now, obey this rule. And now if you get huffy about it and say, I refuse to, well, then you're going to get fined. But then you know what the law is, even though it may be bad.
Saying that the union movement or the specific union working good with this business because they don't have any strikes, but they could be spending both sides millions of dollars in their competition, in their fight to avoid the strike, and the fact they haven't had any strike doesn't mean it's working well. If that's the only goal, if your only goal is not to have strikes, then it's working well, but the goal is to have good business, labor management relations, and everyday good relations, and they aren't existing. They're just spending millions of dollars on that fight. Well, the fact that they haven't gone to jail doesn't mean that the system is working good. They're spending.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm trying to answer the complaint of businessmen, a complaint that I've read several sources, that this is contrary to the American spirit, that you leave the law very vague. A man should not go to jail for a violation of a law that he had no chance to understand. Ignorance of the law may be no excuse, but my gosh, when everybody is ignorant of the law, when the Supreme Court doesn't know what the law is, you can't send some poor little businessman to jail. And what I'm saying is that particular complaint, I think, is largely irrelevant. Yeah. Well, Vern, that's all I want to say. Would you care to respond now to...
First of all, to take up the last thing, which we're just talking about on crimes, imprisonment in particular, I think that as long as this is a federal body of law, that Paul is absolutely right, that the practical chance that anyone will go to prison for a crime that he didn't commit knowingly is pretty small on the federal level. I do have a feeling that when it gets down to a state level, or if it ever got into a place where an administrative body proceeding could be used as the basis for a criminal conviction, that then there would be some danger of abuse of the criminal sanction. With reference to a couple other points, I can't pass by mentioning the fact that with a body of people like undertakers who get to screen their own profession, that this is understandable because this is a very grave undertaking. Now that I've gotten that out of my system, and I apologize for it. The other side of a couple of these pictures, very quickly, take for example the matter of General Motors and the observations that Paul was making. General Motors has been an efficient firm. And yet there is a very large segment of people who would like to cut General Motors into a great many segments on the theory that it would produce better. Once upon a time, we had over 200 separate individual automobile manufacturers in the United States, 200 separate firms manufacturing cars. Now, somewhere along the line, there is an economy of scale that Paul would know more about than I. You have a feeling that not everyone can build automobiles in his basement in a small operation. Some place it gets to the right size, and this is part of the game, is trying to figure out when you're at the right size. And when General Motors is beyond that size and is now just bigger and not more efficient, then this is the place where you start wondering about cutting them back. The basic problem with a firm like United States Steel, as far as the lawyer is concerned, is the matter of some sort of regularity, justice, fairness, that gets into the picture. A good illustration of this is the Columbia Steel case, and to bring that very complex problem down to a couple sentences, if I can, to illustrate the point. Right after the Second World War, when the United States government was disposing of its own factories that it had built during the war, they had a fabricating plant, that is, a plant that takes the sheet metal, the plates, and so forth, and makes it into, fabricates it into things like windowsills and other articles. They had a plant out in California they wanted to get rid of. They wanted somebody to buy it. Consolidated Steel, they made ships mostly. They wanted somebody to buy it, somebody to run it, and put it into operation. And the government surplus properties administration approached Mr. Fairless in United States Steel and asked whether or not they'd take the plant and buy it. And Fairless said, in effect, "Are you nuts? Do you think that we're about to buy any additional capacity for United States Steel when the antitrust department is already breathing down our neck?" So then they went around and took proposals from other people. "Will you buy this plant?" And the reaction in each case was that, well, if the United States government will loan us enough money to buy it, and somehow or other get us efficient people so that they can run it, well, yes, we'd be happy to take it over. There was no one else. That's about what it came down to. Finally, United States Steel, having been approached twice more, bought it. After going to the Attorney General of the United States and having it run through there on an advisory opinion to see to it that they wouldn't be violating the antitrust laws, then they picked up the plant, and there was an immediate decrease in competition in steel because U.S. Steel is now spread even further west. Whereupon the United States Attorney General brought an action for violation of the Sherman Act. New Attorney General by this time, but there it is. Now, when that case got to trial, there is this basic underlying procedural aspect of justice or fairness about sort of keeping your deals with a guy. It had nothing to do with efficiency of performance at this place, and this is a problem which the law faces here, where one set of pressures to dispose of surplus property plays off against another set of pressures to keep your competitive economy viable. And as much as I admire the ability of an economist, and I do, I'm serious about this, to analyze these things clearly in terms of structures and performance and efficiency, this is not enough when you've got the legal problem before you, because there are a whole bunch of other factors that play into it also. The must be taken into consideration, which really have nothing to do with efficiency. Illustration, the same sort of thing with the drug industry. My adrenaline comes up too when I think about some of the things in the drug industry. On the other hand, as they are so fond of pointing out, the new miracle drug that you want to buy down at the drugstore is years in development, and it costs minimums of $3, $4, $5 million to bring that new mold from the test tube through all of the guinea pigs and rats and mice and human beings and field testing and the other processes that it must be subjected to before it ever gets into the bottle on the shelf. Now, somehow or other, the law must encourage people to develop new medicines, and if you're encouraging them to spend $3 or $4 million in the development of a drug which they may never be able to sell, and they're going to have to write that right off. This is a major investment, and before a firm will do it, they want to be sure that somehow or other they're going to have some sort of return on it. And at this point, you get into patentability and protection of trade names, trademarks, this sort of thing, which is really monopolistic behavior. Basically, very quickly now, so you can talk enough me, there's two points that I really want to leave at this point. One is the very difficult problem of proof in these cases. Again, I'm in agreement with Paul that in the Sherman Act violation involving people who may go to jail, that there is ordinarily really very sharp and clear proof of what happened. But to get that proof is extremely difficult. In the electrical conspiracy case, which he mentioned, which is a classic case, there has never been one like this one before, so clear. That happened because a disgruntled vice president, if I remember correctly, having left one of the corporations just about the time that the Attorney General's office in the United States was ready to give up on this case because they couldn't get any proof. This guy wanders in and spills the beans. And he told them all about their meetings and their hotel arrangements and how they phased their pricing systems by the phases of the moon and this sort of thing. He told them this. You see, this was a security leak that comes along once in a while, but there are, for every one of these cases, there are probably 100 that never surface. To use the GM illustration again, the Attorney General has thought for years that GM was too big, too powerful, and could produce Chevrolets at a much cheaper price than they do. Of course, they're not at all sure that they want GM to produce Chevrolets at a much cheaper price, because if they do, Ford and Chrysler are going to have an even rougher time than they've got now. But at least let's find out about it. So the Attorney General moved in part of his staff, six people to be precise, into the General Motors Administration Building. And they officed there for several years. When the GM workers went to work in the morning, these six troopers from the Federal Attorney General's office marched into their offices and their desks too, and for a period of several years they lived in the building, worked in the building, looking over the files, trying to find enough evidence of one type or another so that they could bring an action against them. They have just now been called back to Washington, unsuccessful. It's tough to get evidence. And as the difficulty of evidence to prove your case of conspiracy mounts, and this is realized, the Attorney General starts to reach for other devices to relieve him from the burden, the stringency of proof. Things like it's called conscious parallelism, the fact that one firm is aware of the fact that it's charging the same prices as its competitor is. Same prices, identical. They are conscious of the fact that their conduct is parallel, and therefore, the government argues, there must be a conspiracy. But is that necessarily true? If sugar is identical and it's sold on the shelves, and if it's clearly branded and you know what you're buying, and it's an identical product except for label, and one bag costs 10 cents more than the other, will you not always buy the cheaper bag? If so, will not the price of the competitors ultimately come down to identical prices for identical products? That's an oversimplification, but that's the way the argument goes. The other and the last comment that I want to make right now is this. Since many of you, at least, are interested in this problem from the point of view of the observer, what do you say about the ethics or the morality or the Christianity of a man who lives in this sort of an environment? That's a tough question. And I think that all that that I could hope to do here right now is to say that you must understand the environment in which he's living. It's an environment in which to force some persons into bankruptcy, to injure them, to put them out of business, and make them suffer for their inefficiency, even to take away their means of earning their living, becomes, if I can look at it this way, a Christian duty. Because to eliminate the inefficient, to force the inefficient producer to the wall in order that he may be replaced by an efficient one, in order that we can have more efficiency, a greater supply of goods, better quality, less price, becomes one's duty, because we need those goods to feed people who are hungry. That's what we're talking about, and one must not judge too quickly the conduct of a man who competes fiercely. Thanks for your time, sir.
Were you going to ask him questions now? Go ahead.
Can I interject something right there that you are mentioning? In our business, we're professional engineers and Christians at the same time, and we are supposed to design a project for a client. It's our duty to do the job properly, save their money, and so forth. But if we work for the state of Ohio or the city of Toledo, or a community, and we design it a certain way, there's certain political producers that have enough power that when we turn our plans in, that they say, no, we don't use that product, you have to use this. And here we've done our job, and in order to fulfill our contract, we have to turn around and do something that we know is wrong.
You want to answer that?
Well, you have to do something that you know is inefficient. It's
we know that a political power has such a hold on forcing us to do it.
Well, I don't think that's your responsibility. I think you can, if you're required to use, say, Joe Doakes's concrete when you, if that's a good enough example.
This is the prime in the state of Ohio, or in particular in our own county. Concrete pipe companies have such a stranglehold that Armco or metal pipe cannot be used. And for a very specific example of Toledo Airport, which I helped design, we had one arch culvert that we needed headroom to get the runway over the terrain that we were working with. And we have just one culvert in the whole airport of all advantage. We made it a metal product, because it's arch instead of round. The concrete pipe people came in and said, no, we'd like to see it altered. We think we can save you some money. So they put in 2 6-foot pipes. Well, if their argument was that they could save money, we went back and we designed the whole airport with an alternate for concrete or metal pipe, because their argument was to save money. Boy, when they saw that alternate plans, it was really the roof going off the building.
I think,
but we have the same thing right now going on in the city of Toledo. The concrete people are just arguing, trying to put every point across that it's better than blacktop.
I think you start out by observing your last statement that you are forced to do this or you have to do this. Of course, that isn't true. You don't have to. You can lose the job. Now, that's a very comforting thought, I know. I often feel this way about people who come in claiming exemption from the draft on basis of religious preferences, beliefs, convictions. And many of these people say, well, I'm forced to do certain things that I don't want to do, which are inconsistent with my position. The answer to that one is you don't have to. You can starve to death. Well, that's, in a very real sense, is unrealistic, isn't it? Literally, we can't starve to death. And those of you who were here last Monday heard me confess my sins in this particular when I start, for example, as a lawyer doing a job. And I come to a place where I now must draft into this bill, or whatever it is that I'm doing, something which I consider less good than something else that I could do. But I've got to do it this way simply because if I don't, it isn't going to go at all. And I take it that you're in this position, in your business also. Now, what is the moral and ethical implication of this sort of thing when you know that you're doing a less able job that you could do, but you simply must do it or else nothing will get done at all? At this point, I comfort myself. Maybe you can rationalize this way too. I comfort myself by saying that this is not a matter of absolutes at all, but it's a matter of utility, of practicability, what can be done. I don't know how far you can go with that, Paul.
That's what I would answer too. After all, you're not in business, you are not pursuing the good with a capital G, but you're pursuing utility.
I don't know if this is just true in other states, it probably is, but in the state of Ohio, consulting firms like that, we're small. In fact, we have three partners with six employees. But the three of us were with a former firm, and we probably did more work towards highway design. We organized it, we had a 40-man working force. And the people in the state workers know the type of work that we can do, our capabilities and everything. The firm that we were with, they can get all kinds of jobs because they have a political go-between. We have nothing, but the people that we would work with in Columbus, not the higher-ups, know that we can do the work, but we can't get work.
Well, you got a business decision to make now.
Right.
You calculate the extra revenue from hiring a lobbyist against the extra cost of hiring the lobbyist, just like you decide whether to hire another bookkeeper. Well, I don't care what you call it, but that's the game. That's the way the game is played.
I mean, they even hire law firms to represent them.
All right, you have to decide whether it would pay for you to do the same thing.
We tried it, but
You may be just saying that you haven't been too successful at getting into the trough, huh?
Well, we've decided that pretty much ourselves that seeing it work and that the men that are doing it are men of our own profession, that we're to the decided.
You're coming close to saying we finally decided it doesn't really pay off, so it's unethical. But if it had worked, you would have done it, wouldn't you?
Possible.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with that. It is not something that is clearly wrong. You've got to bring influence to bear. If all of the people who are scrupulous bring no influence on government and the system which runs by influence, I'm not endorsing all kinds of influencing, but in such a system you've got to play the game, or else all the scrupulous people are going to be left out in the cold.
Scrupulous ones that I've seen do it are men with great talent.
Well, all the worse then. If a guy has great talent, but he says, I am not going to descend to the grubby level of politics, his great talent is going to wither on the vine. And it's not going to do society any good.
His talent worked around to the point where he got lazy and started doing his thing.
Well.
One man, he had such a poor influence on our office. He had good influence in Columbus, Ohio, but he had such a poor influence on the people that we were working for. We finally asked him if he would not come into the office while we were doing the work.
Yeah.
Maybe it would be comfortably right because one isn't taught what if in group that came out with from Ohio, they're the local newspaper reporter that gets people agitated concerning this, but he's been being legally in since there was discussion, he knew of this and went along with it. And maybe it could be a simple problem.
Yes, the United States Supreme Court decided that last year. The case was Noer against the Eastern Railways President's Association or some such thing. The railway lines decided that they wanted to take the business away from the truckers. And so the railway lines got together and they said, let's lobby, let's get newspapers to carry stories, let's get magazines to write articles, let's have speakers go out and speak. Telling people what trucks really do to the highways, how they really cost you more than trains, and they poured it on. And the truckers said, well, this is a conspiracy among the railway presidents to destroy competition by maligning the trucking industry and by influencing legislators to pass legislation favoring railways over trucks. And the U.S. Supreme Court says that's freedom of speech, it's a protected activity, both as freedom of speech and as political activity. And as long as you are only informing the legislators, now if you're not taking them out and buying them vicuna rats and this type of thing, if it's honest information from your point of view, honest now meaning, we're trying to tell you why our product is better than their product, and you can do an awful lot of puffing within that. That's legitimate activity.
Excuse me. Yeah, there was that.
You know, relevant thing that somebody goes through it, this what you have to do to
yes.
Law. But if it becomes a gross perversion.
Well, how?
So many are doing it that a gross perversion of economic justice in our society.
To some extent, when so many do it, it begins to cancel out. You know, the congressmen are not that susceptible to pressure. They do not merely count the number of postcards that come in, mimeographed postcards. And in this case, one of the interesting things that was finally let go by is this puffing or is this fraudulent? They hired Carl Bjorn Associates, a big PR firm, the Eastern Railroad Association, to handle their publicity campaign. And of course, one of the best things to do is get the people to write to their congressmen about how they hate those trucks on the road. And so what they do is send out little cards, and all you gotta do is sign your name and mail it in, postcards. But one batch got mailed in with the rubber band still around them. You mean go along
with
wheeling and
of political pressures or inferior product?
I think there's a danger that we exaggerate here now. Well, let's try to keep this in perspective. Government buys a lot of things, not as much as we sometimes pretend. A great deal of government purchasing is done under an adequate system of safeguards, and much of it is is just purchasing in the market at the going prices. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't room for a good deal of mismanagement by government in order to benefit particular interests, when those interests have, in the first place, exerted undue influence on some legislators or key officials at the State House. But I think it is important that we keep this sort of thing in perspective. It isn't all that important. Now, in his business, it's going to loom very large. In most businesses, it doesn't loom that large. And the danger always of letting a relatively minor problem get too big in our minds is that we may go out and do a great deal of damage in the attempt to cure a relatively minor problem. You know, amputate a guy's arm because he's got a bad mosquito bite.
Yet we have an urban situation where a city is quite a force these days. a big city, and one city can get off where this becomes relatively a major way of life. And then the city can suffer for it and get behind other cities.
Yeah. Well, it can, and when this happens, we are finally forced to rely upon the intelligent and informed public opinion stimulated by crusading journalists and perhaps some businessmen who are angry because of the way the system cut them out.
It takes quite a while, but I've seen the city take a perverse pride in being corrupt, trying to perverse it. That becomes a tradition. Actually, it's hard to get beyond tradition pretty well instilled. And eventually, it can, but I can get to be a difficult situation. Where it's not just a wrong, a lack of a right, but it's actually a strange perversity of pride in a wrong.
Well, I'm sure we'd agree that's bad.
I'd like to raise an area. I wonder if sometimes we just think efficiency almost a second god or goddess in our society, where we have a kind of a compulsive neurosis in being efficient to the fact that we destroy the human element.
Well, I'd like to comment on that. Efficiency I define as economy in the use of means to achieve given ends. That's the general definition of efficiency. Defined in this way, the efficient way to do anything or to live is the rational way. Efficiency is a matter of choosing the means most appropriate to the ends, whatever the ends may be. I think rather than say that we may be too obsessed with efficiency, I think it would be more useful to say that we have not defined our goals clearly enough, or we have not recognized clearly enough the goals that we are seeking, or perhaps we have not recognized that there should be some goals that we're seeking that we are not now seeking. But I'd like to separate as clearly as possible the business of choosing what we finally want from the question of now utilizing the means to get there. Because the task of choosing means is a more scientific one. It is one on which we can more intelligently debate. It is something where standards of evidence are more relevant. It's something, therefore, that a democratic society can more effectively manage, the business of choosing means, than this very complex business of choosing ends. Economy or efficiency is a very important value, not just in economic life, but in art and in everything that we do. Even in lovemaking, there is economy. To say you love her not too much and not too little, you know, all of life, I've frequently been impressed with this, that all of life is a matter of using economy. And the guy who economizes is not some kind of grubby, materialistic scrounge, but he is a man who has a sense of the fitness of things and doesn't hunt butterflies with a buffalo gun, because that's uneconomical.
Well, I thought the thing comes to the point that is there efficiency towards efficiency for efficiency's sake? I think one of the things we can see in our own United States is we're getting to the point that we've been so efficient that we have life stranded. We need life stranded.
Well, now, give me an example.
Well, what has been the biggest task in our labor unions lately is just to merely to have a position to work in, because we've been so, pardon the expression, damn efficient that we don't really need to, but we almost have to create work.
Yeah, but now, that isn't efficient. This problem arises largely from our inefficiency. Now, in order to show what this means, I have to spend a lot of time. But you're using the word efficiency here as a synonym for technological innovation.
Well, this is part of being efficient, Tony.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Is it efficient, for example, in India, to put up a steel mill and make that steel mill as up-to-date, technologically, as is possible, scientifically possible? And the answer is no, because India has a shortage of capital and a surplus of labor. How about with textile mills? If you put up textile mills, textile mills tend to use a lot of labor. It'd be a good thing to put up in a country with a labor surplus and a capital shortage. What kind of textile mill should you put up? Should you put up a modern automated one? Or one that uses a great deal of labor and has a minimum of machinery? And the answer would be, for India, the latter is more efficient. In the United States, no, the former is more efficient. But if in the United States we have jiggled around the price of labor, if we have pushed this up by political action and collective bargaining supported by the power of government to a level where the price of labor is now so high that the business firm says, it'd be cheaper to produce this by getting rid of 90% of the labor force and hiring machines, then it is our inefficiency in pricing resources which will cause the unemployment. We can be so inefficient in our system of social coordination that we create unemployment. But now people turn around and say, aha, more efficiency, but at the cost of unemployment. And I would say it is the inefficiency in many cases which creates the unemployment. Now, not in all cases, surely, but there is, it's surprising how often you can find inefficiency in the mechanism of coordination. Just plain, ordinary price fixing. The setting of prices on labor without attention to the demand for labor and the supply of labor is often responsible for this unemployment, which, as you say, leaves people stranded. If you run through the pockets of unemployment, the industries with which you've created pools of unemployment, what do you get? You get automobiles, steel, coal, railroads, all characterized by strong unions that have been very successful in pushing up wages and in pricing their membership out of the market, in stimulating automation. We surely cannot, as a society, tell a group of workers, you guys just go ahead, set your wages at any level you want to, because God is on the side of the laboring man, and so the nation must be too. No matter what price you set, we'll support it. And now, if some people become unemployed, if the number of jobs in this industry shrinks, well, that's a social problem. What we'll do is tell the firm, which is paying your people $4.50 an hour, you got to do something about these people. You can't fire them. You got to keep them on the job. Nasty old firm here that just loves property more than people and puts in new machines. We're not looking at the source of the problem. We are allowing people to feather their nests at the expense of the public. And then we're saying that when this group begins to suffer the repercussions of its own actions, we'll bail them out. Now, I cannot accept that as a principle for public policy.
There are two problems here that I think have got to be kept distinct. One is the question of how do you produce goods efficiently? How do you produce wealth efficiently? The other question is, what do you do with the wealth after you produced it? And in the one of these, how do you produce it, is a pretty largely an impersonal process that I, if I understand Paul correctly, I would agree with. That is, if you can do it without anybody in the factory, great. The other question is, what do you do with the wealth after you put it together? Well, wealth is for people to use. And now you've got another set of problems, and that is, how do you get this into the hands of the people who are going to consume it? with the kind of efficiency that we'd like to have, so that no one is starving to death, so that everyone is prospering as much as they can. And these two things are not necessarily related to each other. You personalize the distribution of the end product, and you impersonalize the production, if you want to look at it that way, and that's not necessarily inconsistent. Incidentally, I want to spend a whole 50 minutes with that next week sometime. It won't do you any good if you're going home this weekend. Well, maybe it will, got to think of it. But for those for those people who are around, well, I'd like to spend some more time with that later.
Well, what do you mean? On which question?
Question of distribution and impersonalization of human beings.
I think what's also involved in here is but I think we're even involved in, should we say, the theology of work. What is work for man? And I think this is one of the problems that becomes involved for man, whether it's efficiency or lack of strong means and so on. But man needs to have some work.
Yeah.
And we're getting to the point that we're...
Well, you know, man has to have some labor.
Well, that's what I mean, labor.
But he doesn't have to have drudgery.
Well, yeah, but there's a difference between when you bring an IBM machine in and to you as an over civilized.
Man must be doing something constructive. This might mean writing poetry.
Could be recreation.
Yes.
Could be recreation.
It doesn't have to be drudgery, you see.
As to help man.
I guess we're going to have to quit, but I want to tell one story before we do.
I want to make one comment.
Okay, let me tell my story, then you can comment. I am, after all, basically an educator, and when we talk about things like this, about updating methods and changing things, I always think of the book. It's a little book that maybe some of you other teachers have read, too, called The Saber-Toothed Tiger Curriculum. And it talks about the first schools that were developed at the time that man was just crawling out of his rock caves and so forth. And they suddenly realized that it was necessary that there be a little bit more efficiency in the process of educating the youngsters how to get along in the world. So the cavemen held a meeting about this. They decided to establish a school, a completely novel idea. And they organized the school, and then they had to decide what to teach in it. Well, there were only a couple things that were really necessary to life. One was how to catch fish by setting up traps in the stream. And the other one was how to protect society against the saber-toothed tiger. So they set up their curriculum and started teaching it. And it went on from century to century and century. And finally, the saber-toothed tiger became extinct altogether. And fishing had changed to a much different sort of a much more efficient way of catching fish. And one day, a citizens group from the community found some reason to question the validity of the curriculum in the school. They were still teaching defense against saber-toothed tigers and how to catch fish by the old method. And so they approached the educators on this. And the educators said this was part of our human culture that they were protecting, and that this was the function of the school. I think this is the kind of confusion that you see also in the economy, where we confuse the thing that we're trying to do. And what we're trying to do here is to produce the goods. And if you've got to change the curriculum to do it, great. Then on the other hand, you maintain the individuality and the humanity of the person in how you handle him with reference to the goods that you produce.
Mm-hmm. Now my comment wants to come down on, and then I'll give you a chance for the last word. My comment wants to come down sort of on the other side of this, that there is inevitably a connection between delivering the goods and preserving humanity. You cannot separate these. And you cannot completely separate distribution from production. You cannot separate the pursuit of the good life from the way in which we earn our living, at least not at the present time. And it may be that we will have to look seriously at some of the goals we are pursuing and ask the question, what price? Progress. But I would not think here of our method of producing so much as the things that we want produced. We revolutionize economic life, displace people, put burdens, heavy burdens of adjustment on people, also by constantly changing private and public demand. We shake people up by, for example, ramming superhighways through the middle of our cities. And we say progress, but is it progress? We say, of course it's progress. It used to take 45 minutes to get from Puxtehuda Heights to downtown, and now it takes 10. Is that progress, though? I think we Americans are so obsessed with technology, perhaps, that we are insufficiently interested in the real quality of the ends that we pursue, and too willing to shake everything up and ram an expressway down. I just think that's a beautiful symbol for what we do. Much too willing to do this, and not sufficiently concerned for the thousands of people who must bear the burden of adjustment to this frenetic pace. It is a question, you know, whether a man can tolerate having breakfast in New York and a second breakfast in San Francisco. Can the human being live with the jet airplane? I really wonder. Well, now, Thoreau, you had a... Oh. All right.
You're... Calisthenics.
Oh, yeah, calisthenics. Up. Let's go. Don't forget to do the deep knee bends.